Hello, and everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of Every Woman, our weekly one-hour feminist show on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is Una here in the studio today with a full house of the Every Woman crew. We have Fiona, a co-producer, sitting across the table from me.
Hello.
We have Anthony sitting here at the table with us as well, at the little round table.
Hello.
And we have Angela behind the soundboard today, acting as our producer.
Hello, world.
We're all very thrilled to have you with us today, and today we intend to open up the phone lines to get some of your opinions, as well as we have a little bit of a roundtable discussion on the results of the recent elections. And we covered some of these topics in a little bit of detail last week, but we had several listeners request that we spend a little bit more time going into some of the background and the potential future ramifications of the many decisions that voters went to the polls to make on election day this month. I forgot what day it was. Was it the 6th? Yes, it was the 6th. Oh, my goodness. See, we're already starting off on a negative. So, Fiona, what is the first topic that you have been following that has been trending about the election and the role of women?
Well, the exit polls and who voted which way by demographic groups. It was mentioned a little earlier on the 10th Voice on Boston Unbothered with our friend Dima Shangamar, but white women were very much swing voters.
In what manner of speaking?
Well, they split their vote 49% for Democrats and 49% for Republicans. And 2 years ago, there was a 9-point lead for the Republicans in 2016 on the exit polls for white women.
So we had a... It's funny, given the continued controversy over the lack of women's involvement at the higher echelons of the Trump administration and several potential policy decisions and directions that seem to be, by some arguments, misogynist, that Republicans are still garnering an even 50% or 49% to 49% of the vote among white women.
And there are photos of the newly elected people, even though there's still a few races not called. And in the photos that they've put together, all of the Republican new candidates were white, and only two of them, I think, were women. And all of the guys were wearing a nice red Republican tie. And then if you take the photos, the headshots of the new candidates, new winners for the Democrats, there was maybe a 50-50 mix of male and female, and big swings in actually having Native American candidates stand and win, and Latinas, and also persons of color, whether black or non-black persons of color, actually standing as candidates for the Democrat Party and winning.
So actually, when you look at a photo of all of the congressional Republicans and try to find someone that is not white, it's like trying to find the person of color in the Abercrombie and Fitch catalog, you know? It's like, where's Waldo every month? Oh, there they are.
Yeah, and it was the same with the photos for, like, the interns in the White House. The White House was living up to its name.
Some other stats that came out that are looking at some other demographic trends among unmarried women, that is single women or potentially widowed, maybe they even killed their husbands, who know, 66% voted Democratic and 31% voted Republican. And among married women, the gap was only about 10% in favor of the Democrats. But in 2016, that gap was just 2%, not even really statistically significant. Mothers, however, voted 60% Democratic and about 40% Republican, but men who identified as fathers favored Republicans and Trump by 2 points. So both a gender and a family-oriented Democratic difference there.
I'd like to know how men who don't identify as fathers split.
I feel like that might have to do with the gun issue, feeling as lots of women that I have talked to at least feel as if they should stop guns in their school in the availability of guns. And lots of fathers feel like they have guns to protect their children that I have talked to. So in that sort of ordinance, if they were mainly concerned with that issue.
That's interesting, because I was thinking that it would be about childcare funding and tax breaks for paying for childcare and parental leave possibilities as well, that I would have thought would have been things that were more heavily Democratic supported.
Second Amendment issues are something that traditionally is a very big divider between male and female votes. I think I saw an average of the last, I think it was five or six two-year election cycles showed that Second Amendment issues, that is protecting gun rights, was something that was favored by almost 75% of male likely voters, but only on the order of about 25% female likely voters. So a very large gun gap in there, so to speak.
And I would like to remind people, if you have an opinion on this, we are taking calls today, and the studio number is 816-931-5534.
Some other things that came up among these exit polls of voters, which you always have to wonder about that, because we saw from the 2016 election that polling both before and after the election is really haphazard and a crapshoot. All of the main pollsters had predicted with tremendous confidence that Hillary Clinton was going to have a cakewalk over Donald Trump, that poor Donald Trump was just going to be embarrassed. He was going to lose by a landslide. And then as election night came and we saw the states fall one by one via the Electoral College system, that wasn't the case. One thing that's interesting among the exit polls from the voters is only 39% of voters said Congress should make impeaching Trump a priority. And I think that's even way too much, because the best that can possibly happen is the House votes to impeach Trump. It goes to the Senate, which is going to have between a 1-3 Republican lead there. It's dead on arrival. Trump gets to go on Twitter and every other social media platform and say, I have a big win. I defeated the efforts to throw me out of office. And it just looks bad for the Democrats. And people are going to wonder, why did they waste their time on something that absolutely could not work?
I think it's interesting. My brain has just gone completely blank what I thought was interesting there. I think it's interesting thinking about how things would be different back in the 90s if things like Twitter and Facebook had been around, with the effort to impeach Clinton over the whole relationship and Intongate, or whatever you want to call it.
The lying under oath was the critical legal factor they were impeaching him over there.
Yes.
And you know, I'm kind of dismayed when I see Nancy Pelosi say that among impeaching Trump, some of her other most important goals are releasing his tax returns. I'm going to make a hazard in guess no one cares about Trump's tax returns, given everything else that goes on a daily basis. It's like every day you open up the news and it's like opening an advent calendar of excrement. That whatever happens on the tax returns is going to be small potatoes. And if Congress really spins its wheels trying to tilt at that windmill.
Actually, I have to disagree with you there, because I saw a lot of people the day after the election, when it became obvious which way the House was going to go, saying, yes, now at last we'll be able to get those tax returns. So I think people do care, but I also don't think that anyone who is a solid Trump voter is going to care what those tax returns show. So some people will be really happy and vindicated that at last they come out, if they do. But I don't think it will make a big difference overall in the whole political window or the makeup of the country.
Even if the said returns come out, everyone pretty much as far as the group that I'm in feels like, as you said, it doesn't matter in the political arena. It's not going to change anything, even if they do come out and go, hey, you, even if they say, even if the taxes show that they didn't pay the taxes or whatever, it's not going to make a difference.
I think if you look at very carefully at the tax returns of anyone, any billionaire in the United States, even the ones that we consider to be the good ones, like Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, that you will find all sorts of nightmares and loopholes and things lurking in there that no one really wants to get out, but that the average voter has difficulty understanding. Kind of like when people actually inspect how hot dogs are made and they find out all the possums and squirrels and other things that go into them. And, you know, it horrifies people, but nonetheless, they're still going to go and order their hot dogs.
I'm just hoping we don't get sued by all of the hot dog makers out there now.
Not to mention, if they impeach Trump, there's all of these people lined up that aren't necessarily what Democrats want. There's Pence, and there's all these people lined up that may and have shown from what they stand on, from what they have said they support, are not going to be any better.
That was one of the warnings Omarosa gave after she was either fired, ousted, whatever, from the White House, because no one can agree on it. She said, if you think Trump is bad, Pence is much worse. You need to keep Trump where he is. And that was a very ominous prediction on her part.
I did see people crowing and laughing and saying, if Trump and Pence were indicted together before anyone else succeeded, then Nancy Pelosi would become the president as Speaker of the House, and that they would actually get a female president in.
I think that's pretty long odds.
Oh, yes, it is. It's ridiculously long odds.
I just want to say you're listening to KKFI on 90.1 FM, Kansas City Community Radio, to every woman. I'm glad to be here today, Angela Believes. I just want to touch on the fact, you know, if they did open the documents for Trump's taxes, I would be happy if action was taken after that, if there was bad information to be found. I would be happy about that. So that's my only concern. If they did do that and if things were found, what would be the action that would be taken? Mm-hmm. And I'm sure I would be elated and excited if the appropriate action was taken. That's my thoughts on that part.
It's the sort of thing that could potentially drag on for years and years, just even relatively mundane tax problems. So maybe your grandchildren will be cheering the result at some point.
And then also, I'd like to, if I may, give an opportunity to our listeners to call in. And do we think that Trump could possibly be impeached? Share your thoughts with us on that, 816-931-5534.
Locally, we had quite a lot of interesting news and some very unexpected turnout in the election. We mentioned last week the election of Laura Kelly to be the governor of Kansas was very widely unexpected. I know there's a lot of people nowadays that are saying on social media, oh, I saw it all along, or I was totally confident, and so forth. But most of the major scientific polling sites, such as Nate Silver's 538 site, Real Clear Politics, and so forth, the CNN's polls had said they had called the race for Kobach in some cases by as much as a 5 to 10 point lead, and instead we saw a significant shift to Laura Kelly, and it almost just came in at the last minute, and I really think that caught a lot of people by surprise.
It definitely points out the flawed system of the polling that you were mentioning earlier. Some of the polling doesn't even consider certain groups of minorities, such as LGBT communities, so trying to figure out how the vote is going to go before the vote goes is sort of a bit difficult to try to create a science for.
And a lot of the polls were saying that Sharice Davids was going to win, and yet they were still predicting that huge gap of losing the governorship. I know that Sharice Davids is only like seat 3 from Kansas, and there was all the rest of Kansas. But it was interesting seeing so many signs for Sharice Davids, and then less signs for Kelly for governor.
Yes, I actually, it was very hard to find signs for Kelly, whereas I saw a tremendous number of Kobach signs in middle to southern Johnson County. And I actually wondered if Kelly had sort of dropped out of the race. And now she's our governor-elect. And it's just stunning how this reversal of what the pollsters had said came about.
Yeah, and being in Missouri, I had heard of Cerise Davis, but I had not heard of Laura Kelly until I was like, oh, Kansas now has a Democratic governor. Oh, I didn't know that.
Kansas has always been a very strange state that traditionally is very highly red, but continues to elect Democratic governors on a semi-regular basis with gaps of Republican governors in between.
Yeah, when I moved over, we had a Democratic governor, Catherine Sebelius, who then left to take the reins on the healthcare system.
Yes, that I think that I don't think that really worked out very well for her. I think she was a much better administrator, being the governor of Kansas and trying to wrangle creating a new healthcare system to encompass many more people on a national level. I mean, that's a very different skill set that's required, and many people felt that she didn't rise to the occasion.
Yes, I mean, no one ever tends to mention her in politics except as former governor of Kansas, and I don't even know what she's doing now. I don't know if she's lobbying or quietly gone into retirement or what.
Know.
It's like one of those 80s things. Where are they now?
Ms. Sebelius, if you're out there right now listening to us, you could call in and tell us what you're up to. But Cerise Davis, now that was a long shot candidate. I was thrilled by the diversity that she brought to the race right from the get-go. Whether or not you wanted to vote for her, she really stood out as a very atypical candidate for the Kansas 3rd District. I mean, a Native American, lesbian, MMA fighter with no previous political experience is taking on an experienced congressman in a very solidly red, traditionally county, and she won by a very significant margin.
Perhaps it's a breath of fresh air.
Totally. Did you all see that coming? I mean, I had my hopes, but I did not know that she would actually take that election over. Did anyone foresee that happening?
As the signs got more and more common around the neighborhood, I actually started to believe it might happen, but given how it traditionally is in that district, I was more hoping than actually believing it would happen.
Mm-hmm. Something seemed to happen in late September. In late September is when I started to see the major polling sites that were showing Yoder with about a 3 to 4 point lead all of a sudden being behind by as much as 10 points, and I really don't know what sea change occurred in about that time frame.
It got cold and it made people bitter.
And you know what, everybody? I just want to go ahead and acknowledge that November is also Native American Heritage Month. And in respect, yeah, hand clap, hand clap. Also, I was born in November, and Fiona was too.
No,
and
I'm late October.
Oh, you are? I thought you were a November baby.
I snuck in under the wire.
You sure did.
Shortly before Halloween.
Well, there's still two people here that have November birthdays.
Yes,
not that anyone's doing any calls for actions for extra birthday presents.
No.
Well, it's my birthday all month, so, you know, feel free to drop off a gift at any time. So, Anthony, when's your birthday?
The 21st. The day after Trans Day of Remembrance.
Awesome. And Una, do you have a birthday this month?
No, but I have a wedding anniversary. Fiona and
so
I were married on we were married on the Thanksgiving weekend. It's a good time to get married because a lot of relatives are already in town and there's already lots of leftovers, so you don't have to cater.
Awesome, awesome. So back to our Native American celebration. Now, Cerise Davis and Deb Hallen are the
Davids. Extra D in the lady's name.
It's Davids?
Yes.
Okay. I thought it was Davis.
No, My former surname, everyone made the same mistake and left a D out of it, no matter... sorry, they always stuck an extra D in it, and no matter how many times I told them it's the other way around.
Okay. Well, I want to go ahead and give the congratulations to the first Native American women who have been elected into Congress. Shout out to that. And actually, Ms. Deb Haaland, she was the former chair of the Democratic Party of New Mexico. And as we know, because Una shared with us that Ms. Charisse Davids, she's actually an attorney at law and a former MMA fighter. And I feel like I'm leaving something else out on her credentials. Did I sum it up all with that?
I don't know. She's done an awful lot.
A lot of people also mentioned that her mother was in the armed forces as well.
Her mother was a drill instructor.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Which is fairly impressive.
So I believe that these aren't just the first Native women, but the first Native people in Congress.
And let's talk about that. We had kind of talked about that before we began the show on why we haven't seen many Native American candidates.
Yeah, so... from my experience as being raised by a Native American mother and going to powwows every summer, being a part of that community, what I saw was that a lot of Native politicians were within Native areas or Native groups, and they did not want to participate in the government, understandably so, since this government sort of took over, as history tells, and that they were not interested. They wanted to be a government for their own people and not be part of the government that took over. So,
do you think because of just a general rejection of that government, or a feeling that if they started to participate in it, they might be granting it some form of legitimacy and blessing?
I'm not really sure. I wasn't ever that involved in the actual politics, but from the feelings of individuals that I have talked to, mostly a feeling of having, for example, if on a reservation, of having, this is our space, this is our land to govern, it's not yours, and we are not going to try to govern your people. Where they didn't have a view of this is the state I'm in and this is what affects me as well. But I definitely feel like the Native peoples have probably been trying to go into politics for a long time, and there's also been probably a lot of... I can't think of words...
Then let me ask you another question. Do you think that the protests with the placing of the pipeline and the possible effects on the water and the very, very lengthy protests against the pipeline placement, do you think that that perhaps encouraged people to look outside of their reservations and think this stuff does affect us and we need to get involved and have some say here?
A lot of Natives feel like even if they're interested in politics, they've been disenfranchised out of federal and state governments. So.
And so it goes along the lines that if you're not sitting at the dinner table, then you must be on the menu. And so it's better to be involved in the politics and work for the greater subject areas that are going to impact all of the communities of the state, and rather than trying to focus just on that individual community.
And I just want to say to add a little bit more to this, I hope that these wins that have come about sparks more voters to come out and vote, and more communities who hadn't been active in voting to come out and vote, and if you want to be interested in politics, to assert yourself in that area. So I think this is a good time for a lot of change to happen for minorities and just individuals as a whole to make our world better.
I think that's really true, and I think if you are interested in voting, especially if you're a minority, definitely educate yourself, because there were several cases of people being turned away at the polls, particularly Native Americans, because they didn't have an official registered postal address. And despite being legally allowed to vote, people were turning them away and saying, no, you can't vote here.
Yeah, that's what we call voter suppression, folks. So that, like Fiona said, get educated, know what's on the ballot, know your requirements, know what you have to do. We don't want voter suppression to continue to happen.
And if they do suppress you, demand a temporary
provisional ballot.
Thank you. Provisional ballot, and then you have time to get them proof that you're entitled to vote.
So are the provisional ballots available in all states?
I think it's most states, but that's why you need to be educated so you can check.
Right, check with your local election board.
There certainly are in Kansas and, from what I've heard, also in Missouri.
So there is also... I had something, then it flew out of my brain, you know that?
So sorry. It'll fly back.
Another subject that's come up has been the loss of Claire McCaskill to Josh Hawley, which was news to a lot of people. A veteran congresswoman, a senator, many people thought that McCaskill, it was her race to lose, and unfortunately for her, that is exactly what she seemed to do.
Yeah, I was certainly surprised when I woke up the next day. The other thing that flew back into my mind is that a couple weeks ago we had two Muslim women come into the studio to talk about how they had been educating and started an initiative to educate about politics and how they explained for some of the same reasons why Muslim individuals hadn't gone into politics or didn't buy into the idea of voting, in quotes. And now we have two women that are Muslims and are the first Muslim individuals in Congress as well.
And I just want to say, there are lots of now you can go and vote. You can get registered to vote. You can go and vote. But it's another thing to understand what you're voting for when you go into that poll and what's on that ballot. And there's a lot of different places that you can go, and I don't have them handy with me. But like I say, I'm sure you can go to your local election board. If you live in Kansas City, I know that is kceb.org. That's the place, and hopefully they have some resources on there. And another time, we'll have to bring that back to you, or there's some agencies that you can go to find out what's on that ballot, because it's important, again, to be educated and know what you're voting for.
We had a struggle in Missouri where there were three medical marijuana measures on the ballot, and there was a great deal of fear among the proponents of medical marijuana that people would be confused by the three different measures, and if all three of the measures had passed, it would actually have set up a rather nasty situation where perhaps the least advantageous method would have been chosen among the three.
But well, my understanding was whichever one actually got the most votes was the one that was going to go into effect, even if all three had enough votes to be passed.
Well,
but some people were confused about whether that, what if that wasn't the amendment? Did amendments trump just ballot measures? So people were uncertain about which ones to vote for, and one of them, quite a lot of people felt, would be very nasty, but it might be better than none at all.
Right. There were two amendments on the ballot, as well as a proposition that would not necessarily be binding to the state legislature, and so it would be sort of like a friendly suggestion, like when someone says you really should try a different deodorant the next time you come to work.
And I know that the legislature has possibly got round amendments before that they didn't like by just failing to fund them. Like if there was an amendment that said no puppy mills, then you can just get round it by failing to provide extra funding for the inspectors who would go out and enforce that. So even then, if there are ways, if you are a political expert, to wrinkle around things.
There's also a little bit of confusion I've heard from, okay, I'll just come out and say, a very large number of my friends are really, really interested in the medical marijuana initiative in Missouri, probably about 90% of my Facebook friends. But there's some things that folks aren't really understanding, and you'll have to read the amendment carefully. For instance, many people are saying, well, I'm going to go to my doctor next week and get my medical marijuana card. No, there's going to be a significant length of time that some estimates say could be as long as until next autumn before the system fully gets set up and in place.
Still, that's a fairly short amount of time for a whole amendment.
But it's not next week or even the end of this year. Another thing is that a lot of people in Kansas have been very enthused, saying, well, my doctor's in Missouri. I can go over to Missouri now, and as long as I get my prescription in Missouri and consume in Missouri, I'm okay. But actually, no. The amendment says very clearly it's only applicable to lawful residents of Missouri. So, Kansans, you're still going to have to...
Sorry, Kansas.
Yeah, keep reaching for that rainbow. That green-colored rainbow.
So I want to delve into that a little bit more if we can. You know, I voted for Amendment 2 because I don't currently have any ailments where the medical marijuana would aid me, but I know a lot of other people do. So because I'm not there yet doesn't mean I can't support those that are. So I am happy that they are able to take advantage of what we voted for. So I'm happy about that. I just wanted to make that known because it seemed a little bit of a sensitive subject to touch on, but it's a fact. I voted for it. I'm happy.
I would have voted for it. I support legalization and regulation because I think it results in a net increase in safety for the general populace. And it also, you know, being a person who suffers from long-term chronic pain, giving people any additional option to help them with a long-term illness or anxiety or PTSD or anything else that is causing a severe negative quality of life for them is certainly, to use a metaphor, being on the side of the angels.
Fortunately, one of the things that people don't necessarily realize is that even with the passing of this amendment, it's still federally illegal, and it's still possible that companies will be performing drug testing and may still fire people for having elements of marijuana present in their blood or their saliva or whichever method they test by.
Although the Kansas City, or at least the Jackson County Police Department, have made a statement that they will not be prosecuting at least for possession of marijuana.
I saw that, yes.
Well, wait. You said they're not. What about those already incarcerated?
Exactly. There's nothing.
What do we do about those?
What's happening with that? We don't know. We hope, or at least I hope.
I haven't heard any propositions for amnesty yet, but that may be forthcoming.
I've seen arguments in like newspaper editorials or whatever that they should pass, like you said, an amnesty or a forgiveness or a pardon for people already in the system.
And that is another thing I want to reinforce to our listeners out there. Many people have told me with great confidence that, well, even though my employer drug tests me, when I get my Missouri medical marijuana card, I'll be able to smoke, you know, on lunch breaks or whatever, and they can't do it. That is not true, because it is still illegal under federal law, and almost every single state's medical marijuana initiative or amendment has language that says employers have broad discretion in making certain that you're not intoxicated on the job. For instance, vodka is perfectly legal to buy right now. You can't come into work, you know, clutching a bottle of Grey Goose and falling on your face on the floor. So the same applies for intoxication by any other means.
Yeah, just like they said in the article I read about the KC Police Department not prosecuting, they will still be prosecuting if it involves child endangerment or if it involves a car accident.
Yeah, driving under the influence for whatever drug or incapacitant would still be an issue.
And I think Angela's point, too, is a very good companion issue that really needs to be addressed anytime we have a decriminalization or legalization issue. What about the amnesty for all of those folks, some of whom were given pretty onerous sentences for simple possession?
Decades.
That
yes.
We are throwing away human lives and human capital over somebody who has a bag of plant in their car, basically.
Especially when especially when there's an institutional bias to do long sentences for persons of color and short ones for white people. It's very often used as a means to disenfranchise people because if they charge it as a felony, then they can't vote. So you're getting, it's voter suppression again. You're getting those people out of the population that can vote.
Which makes me want mention Florida, because Florida passed an amendment that says they're felonins. They're felonins.
they're Floridian felons.
Can we now what? Vote.
Felonious Floridians. Sounds like a...
You know, though, the felons still can vote. It just depends on what you were convicted of that determines whether you are allowed to vote in whatever state that you're in. I know, again, I have that information somewhere else, so I can bring it back to you another time. But in Missouri and Kansas, it's very similar, but it just depends on the crime you committed that determines whether you're eligible to vote or not.
And for the length of time, because some of them, it's a certain length of time, but there is a... There's an actual crime of voting while a felon and while disbarred. And that itself is a felony and then rebars you from voting. So some people have ignorantly not known that they couldn't vote and then they've had the book thrown at them and then some of them have had like sentences of going to jail again for 10 years over voting by mistake.
Another surprise that I had during this election was the amount of Green Party signs, speaking of green things, that I saw in my neighborhood. I want to talk a little bit about that since there are other parties, technically. There's Libertarians and Independents and Green. But at this point, they do not have enough publicity or enough supportive individuals to... combat the two-party system.
They don't have enough. There has to be a critical mass that they reach so that they become enough of a disruptive influence to an election that one of the big two parties has to form a coalition with the third party and reach out and involve them. And that this comes into something you talked about earlier, Anthony, that you brought up that I thought was very astute. Some people have been blaming progressives for the downfall of Claire McCaskill, saying that she alienated a lot of progressives with one of her campaign ads where she said she wasn't one of those, quote, crazy Democrats, unquote. And I know quite a lot of progressive friends of mine did take significant umbrage at that remark. However, as you pointed out, Anthony, Josh Hawley's vote, his gap in the vote was so great that even if all of the third party and...
The 3.8% of people that voted other parties, which was about, I know in Kansas City at least 33,000 people voted for the Green Party approximately.
It still wouldn't have mattered because Hawley had a 51.4% lead. And you know that a significant number of people that would vote Libertarian would likely be on the... Republican side. Libertarians are a little unusual. Some of them are so far to the right that they come full circle all the way around to the left, kind of like a Mobius strip of politics.
And I know that I was getting tons of texts by both parties, both major parties, and also by some of the independent candidates. And the independents, I was telling them, I'm voting for this way because I believe in LGBT rights and women's rights and so on and so forth. And they're like, oh, but my candidate has a better record on that than, say, the Democratic candidate on that. And therefore, I was like, I am not voting for you because, in my opinion, you, when so many people were against possibly having second session of bad budget in Kansas, that... you threw out that ability because if you added up the votes in that occasion, the votes for the independents plus the votes for the Democratic candidate actually added up to more than for the Republican candidate. And that I'm like, I am never voting for a third party while we have such a very bicameral, bi-state, bi-powerful party system.
One of our listeners out there messaged me because they wanted me to make a note on this. Jumping back 5 minutes ago to medical marijuana, they thought was important. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in the United States has ruled that just the possession of a medical marijuana card, whether or not you ever get a prescription filled or whether or not you ever take possession of marijuana has been found to be sufficient proof to deny you permanently from being able to legally own a firearm under a federal law. Federal law specifically states and even lists it on Form 4473, the yellow form you fill out when you buy a firearm, that you cannot be a user of any substance which is deemed illegal under federal law. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals dealt with a case where a woman said she had obtained a medical marijuana card with the intent of making a political statement by getting it, but never filled a prescription, was denied the right to purchase a firearm, and that has been upheld. And so I know there are other cases in other circuits, and this may eventually go to the Supreme Court. And even as with a 5-4 conservative majority in the Supreme Court right now, that conservative majority is not necessarily Second Amendment friendly. So it could really go anyway.
Yeah, that's a really interesting one, and I'm really glad someone brought that into your attention.
Yeah, more news stories that we don't that need to get more attention because there are just so many.
And I mean, it's possible if you've got another prescription item, like for opiates, it's entirely possible that they, since those are illegal if you don't have them by prescription, it's possible someone could try and make an argument that you shouldn't have that anyway.
The law only refers to things that are illegal under federal law.
Okay.
I mean, if you use somebody else's prescription, if you borrow their OxyContin, but you don't actually have a prescription for it, even though the drug is legal, you're using it illegally, so you're an illegal user. But hopefully none of us are doing that. I know we have a short station break that we're about to go to here, so let's go ahead and hear a couple messages and be right back to finish up some of our little political roundtable.
This week, Sprouts presents Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. On this edition, we begin a conversation about transgender youth who want to begin medical transition at an early age, and about the advantages and disadvantages of early transition. That's this week on Sprouts for Pacifica.
Thursday at noon, after my police.
This is federal worker Cynthia Lee of the Department of Treasury Financial Management Service, and I encourage all of my federal worker friends to support KKFI 90.1 FM during the combined federal campaign. Donating a few dollars each pay period can help keep community radio on the air in Kansas City. Designate your tax-deductible donation to KKFI, CFC Agency Code 21994. Thank you for supporting community radio.
And we're back to Every Woman on KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City Community Radio. We want to thank you for tuning in to our roundtable discussion that we're having. And as I said, we were previously talking about felons having the right to vote. And I think there's a lot of misinformation floating around out there. And I just want to kind of clarify that for those who need it. For the state of Missouri, the qualifications to vote if you are a felon are: you must be registered to vote in the jurisdiction of the person, the domicile prior to the election. You cannot be in prison. You cannot be on probation or parole after conviction. Cannot have been convicted of a felony or misdemeanor connected to voting, and cannot have been declared incapacitated. Now, for the state of Kansas, I am going to refer you to the Secretary of State website. That is sos.ks.gov to find out that information for Kansas. That's the State of Secretary website to find out more information on felons' criteria for voting.
So one of those that you said were, I know you said can't be convicted of any misdemeanor or felony regarding voting. So would that be a perpetual banning, or would that just be until the probation or whatever lapses for that?
You know, I'm looking at this, and as I was saying that it read a little odd, so I'm going to read it again to see if that changes anything. If not, we'll go over it. So, cannot be on probation or parole after conviction of a felony. So it sounds like you cannot actively be on probation or parole at the time that you're wanting to vote. Did it come across right that time?
Yeah.
I must have read it inaccurately first go around. Yeah, so.
Well, and it looks like I found a nonprofit that says it's very similar for Kansas. You can't vote while incarcerated, on probation, or on parole. And it says, the nonprofit says that automatically restored upon completion of all of your supervised release, which, since that's a nonprofit, you probably still should double check things if you're concerned at the Secretary of State Department site that you mentioned earlier, just to be on the safe side.
Yes.
So we have 2 years until 2020, and we already know who the Republican candidate is likely to be because Donald Trump filed for re-election on his inauguration day for the 2020 campaign. But the question is, what are we going to see from the Democratic field? There was news in just last week that Hillary Clinton is very seriously and very strongly considering running again against Trump.
Well, I saw articles about that actually the day before the election, and it was an interview at that point in time that said someone asked her, was she going to run again in 2020? And she firmly said no to that. And then they asked her if she would like to be president, and she said, yes, I would like to be president. So the way it's been spun, the headlines all say Hillary to run again in 2020, made me think that maybe those were perhaps more right-leaning news outlets that were trying to panic people and make them go out and vote in this current midterm, more Republican-leaning, to try and block the possibility that Hillary may eventually somehow come back and butt her emails.
A lot of candidates also will throw out trial balloons with little teasers and hints like that to see how it plays in the press. Bernie Sanders is reportedly considering running again, although he would be about 80 years old if he was elected in 2020, and that would be a concern. He also does not poll as well with several minority communities, especially the African-American vote. Joe Biden comes up as another option, but again, he would be quite elderly when he took office against Trump. Beto O'Rourke, the Democrat who almost unseated Ted Cruz, who was in a lock-solid Republican fortress in Texas, has already been touted as a potential challenger. And people say anyone that can get, almost steal a Senate seat, so to speak, from a hardline Republican in Texas probably could get a lot of interest in the country.
I've seen a lot of posts on Facebook and particularly on Twitter with people saying Beto O'Rourke 2020. A lot of interest and talk and chatter about that.
It's almost as important, I guess, is who is going to take over the House. It seems to be that Pelosi is the heir apparent. She certainly believes that she is. There is a large groundswell among Democratic congresspeople, including the influx of the new Democrats like Charisse Davids. I'm not speaking for Charisse Davids specifically because I don't know how she feels about this, but that feel we need a younger, fresher face to lead the House. Another thing is that the Republicans have used Pelosi as the boogeyman, so to speak, in campaign ads, in attack ads, in social media for the last 10 years, 12 years, and her brand is kind of used up at this point. So
I've seen, even in the past week, her being used as that boogeyman thing, and media stories being spun of divisions in the Democratic Party because there was a demonstration in the corridors, a sit-in, that was protesting and trying to encourage more progressive actions. And one of the incoming people went and spoke to them and addressed them. And she actually told them that their views would be heard and that these platforms are actually part of our platform and things like that. But all of the media spun it as this person went to this protest that was a protest against Pelosi, and therefore it's a division and a split already within the Democratic Party, and they're not even in power yet.
Other people say that Pelosi also has an extremely long career, has deep connections throughout both sides of the house, and she's the person that knows where the bodies are buried. And that's usually just an expression, but supposedly she really does. However, you know, the era of Mitch McConnell and his essentially totalitarian rule of the Senate, which has completely destroyed any hint of bipartisanship in the last 2 years, doesn't really give much incentive for Pelosi, who is going to have, what, a 28 to 30 vote lead. She doesn't need to reach out to the other side of the aisle anymore. She can basically be the Democratic Mitch McConnell and just run through whatever the party wants.
From what I have heard from my youth group of friends, that's exactly what they want. They don't want any reaching across the aisles. They just want the madness to stop.
I get the impression that people are saying, if you reach across the aisles on something that is sexist or racist or anything else-ist, then you're being as bad as them because you're enabling that. It's like there's a old joke, which isn't all that funny, about what you call 10 people sitting down at a table with a Nazi, 11 Nazis. And so the argument here is, if you reach across the aisle and you say you'll help them with their stuff if they help you with yours, well, one, they may not help you with yours afterwards and they've already got what they want, and the other thing is you're still throwing your people under the bus, throwing the American people under the bus.
I think that I think it's likely Pelosi will end up getting the House leadership, and so that, that really is a foregone conclusion at this point. And there's actually a risk, if there's too much division or too much rancor fighting over who takes control of the House, it could risk making the Democrats look bad and actually making matters a little bit worse for them. Still don't know, however, exactly who could potentially run against Trump in 2020. There's even some rumors that maybe Trump will change his mind in a mercurial turn of mood and just decide he doesn't want to run anymore. It's time to bring this to a close and go to a little bit of music before we leave the show, and hope you enjoyed our
roundtable discussion.
Our amateur discussions of politics here. None of us are political candidates or enmeshed in any sort of political apparatus, even at the local level, but we're three women and a guy that keep our eyes open and have been trying to work through these issues, and especially how they impact women. So Fiona, Anthony, Angela, thank you very much for talking with us here today. And all of you, please join us again next week for more Every Woman. You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.